All right, good afternoon, everyone. We're gonna go ahead and get started now. Thank you all for coming. My name is Maddie Conover, and I'm a third-year law student here at UVA, and I'm the editor-in-chief of the Journal of Law and Politics. Founded in 1983 under the guidance of then-Circuit Judge Scalia, the Journal of Law and Politics provides a forum to discuss, debate, and analyze the interaction of law and politics. We are thrilled to be here today, celebrating a historic milestone in Virginia's political and legal history, the 50th anniversary of the 1971 Constitution. Dean Golubac has graciously agreed to give some opening remarks, so I'm going to pass the mic to her.
Thank you, Maddie. Good evening, everyone. It is wonderful to see you all here tonight. Welcome to the first of two sessions commemorating the 50th anniversary of the 1971 Virginia Constitution. I'm going to talk fairly quickly. I always do that, but I'm going to talk fairly quickly on purpose because I know you really want to hear from our panelists. So I just want to say three things. First is thank you. Thank you to the Journal of Law and Politics and its editorial staff and leadership, especially Maddie Conover and Andy Schlute, for organizing this series and for publishing the papers from the symposium. I look forward to reading them. Second, I want to note that these sessions are a commemoration of both a constitution and a person. So in 1968, Governor Mills E. Godwin Jr. created a blue ribbon commission charged with revising Virginia's constitution, which was a Jim Crow constitution dating back from 1902. The commission in turn asked Professor Dick Howard, then 34 years old, to serve as its executive director. In that capacity, Professor Howard was the constitution's primary draftsman. The proposed constitution sought to unmake Jim Crow against the backdrop of massive resistance to the civil rights era and the civil rights movement. Important changes included an assurance that every resident of the state of the Commonwealth of Virginia would have access to an education. For that, we have to thank in large part Professor Howard, a real live constitution maker, colleague, and friend. Few of us get to write constitutions, let alone watch them mature into adulthood, or to consider their successes and sometimes their failures. Commemorating the Constitution and the man are thus more than appropriate. They are cause for celebration. This leads me to my third and final point. While in law school, we spent a lot of time thinking and talking about the United States Constitution, and we sometimes forget that there are 50 state constitutions and that they have a lot to say. State constitutions govern so many more aspects of our everyday lives than the federal constitution does. They change more often, they are usually longer, and they are more susceptible to social movements and change. So this commemoration, I hope, will be a reminder for all of you about the great legal work that can and should be done at the state level as well as the federal level. And I urge you as students to think about this as you are listening to our panelists, which include Aaron Ashwell, Chief Deputy Attorney General for the Commonwealth of Virginia, and Professor Rich Schrager, who studies state and local government law. State constitutional practice is hugely consequential, it's hugely important, and it's very fulfilling. So with that, I will turn things back over to Maddie Conover to introduce the panelists more formally. Thank you and enjoy.
All right, thank you, Dean Golubac. Before commencing this discussion on the history and structure of the 1971 Constitution, I would like to introduce our panelists and our moderators a little bit more than Dean Golubac already did. So Professor Howard is the Warner Booker Distinguished Professor of International Law here at the law school. After graduating from UVA Law, he went on to clerk for Justice Hugo Black of the U.S. Supreme Court. Professor Howard, as Dean Golubac mentioned, is the chief architect of the present Constitution of Virginia. He was also primarily responsible for directing the successful referendum campaign for the Constitution's ratification. Professor Howard's paper on the historical evolution of Virginia's Constitution will be published in a special edition of the journal that's coming out later this academic year. Professor Schrager is the Per Bowen and Martha Lubin Karsh and Bruce A. Karsh Bicentennial Professor of Law. He is also a senior fellow at the Miller Center. Professor Schrager's scholarship focuses on the intersection of constitutional law and local government law, federalism, urban policy, and the constitutional and economic status of cities. Professor Schrager's article, The Failure of Home Rule Reform in Virginia, Race, Localism, and the Constitution of 1971, was co-authored by Alex Retzloff, an alumnus of the journal, and will also be published later this year. Also, Alex is here today, so welcome, Alex. Last but not least is our moderator, Aaron Ashwell. Aaron is the Chief Deputy Attorney General for the Office of the Attorney General of Virginia. In this role, she supervises the work of the Office of the Attorney General and its provision of legal services. Prior to her appointment, she was a partner at Woods, Rogers, and Roanoke, Virginia. While there, she focused on appellate work and frequently litigated before the Supreme Court of Virginia. We are very honored to have you all here, and thank you for coming. I'm going to pass it over to you.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It's a treat to be in person and to actually get to have a conversation that doesn't involve any buffering or reminders to mute or unmute. So you may regret your inability to mute me at some point, but I invite you just to tell me. We have today a conversation, I think, that is fundamentally about community and about who makes decisions in government. And I'm gonna, I think we're gonna start by inviting our two panelists to talk about their papers. But the concept I want to start with is, on some level, we know that deciding at what level of government a decision is made is a question of saying who gets to decide, but sometimes that also becomes dispositive of the outcome of the question. And so that's a notion I hope we can return to after we talk about the evolution, Professor Howard, of the Virginia Constitution and the very important replacement that, I mean, it's such a privilege to get to talk to you about this, like, as a person who dearly loves constitutionalism and the Virginia Constitution, to get to sit here on the panel with you is a real treat. So can you talk to us about the 1971 Constitution and its replacement of the deeply racist 1902 Constitution?
Okay, well, first, thank you to the Journal of Law and Politics for organizing this event. Wonderful turnout. Thank all of you for your interest. And it occurs to me that I ought to say a couple of words at the very outset about why state constitutions matter. I mean, when I was in law school, I'm a UVA graduate, and I don't recall in 3 years any of my professors talking about state constitutions. I mean, maybe I was nodding or cut class or, you know, who knows what. But I literally don't recall that. It was only by working on the Virginia Constitution that I was thrust into the world of state constitutions. So a word or two about why they matter. First, their origin is different. They came out of an age of popular sovereignty in the Revolutionary period. They're much closer in that sense to the will of the people than the federal document was. Secondly, they are longer and more detailed, much, much, much longer. Some of them have amazing detail, like the Louisiana Constitution, which declares Huey P. Long's birthday to be a state holiday in the state of Louisiana, stuff like that. They are instruments of government and not simply frames of government. They go into lots of areas untouched by the federal constitution, education being simply one example among many. Thirdly, they're easily amended. In most states, you go into the polling place and there are constitutional amendments on the ballot. Fourthly, they are, in most states, periodically revised. Virginia, depending on how you count, has had 6 or 7 constitutions since 1776. Fifthly, they embody popular constitutionalism. And by that, I mean there are many more ways that people can lay their hands on their state constitution as opposed to the federal document. You have in many states the initiative and referendum. You have recall of judges. Many states elect their judges popularly. And as I said, they're easily amended. So there are just lots of ways for people to have their say about what they think their state constitution ought to do. And finally, and I think in contemporary times, especially important, state courts can use state constitutions to create a body of rights and law over and beyond the federal constitution. So there are just lots of ways they matter. I think the lives of ordinary people in day-to-day terms are much more governed by their state constitution than by the federal document. So the Virginia Constitution, as I say, there have been 6 or 7 over the years, And the point where I want to begin is language that George Mason used in his famous Declaration of Rights in 1776. And he started out with very broad John Lockean social compact language about the common benefit. But then when it comes to who actually gets to vote, he says it's those people who have a permanent common interest in an attachment to the community. Well, that was a bit vague, but what it obviously meant in 1776 was people that own property. So over the years, in the 2.5 odd centuries since 1776, the search has been for deciding what you mean by the political community. Who are the people that count? Who counts and who doesn't? Who belongs and who doesn't? Now, in the 19th century, and several revisions in that period, the franchise was progressively enlarged until, in 1851, the Constitution was essentially white male universal suffrage. 1870, after the Civil War and the Reconstruction period, then, of course, former slaves, African Americans, were added to the franchise, obviously in good part because of federal pressure. Then things change in 1901, 1902. After the last federal troops left the South in 1877, Reconstruction is at an end, and the conservative forces couldn't turn the clock all the way back. I mean, they couldn't reinstitute slavery, but they wanted to put blacks in a period of inferiority insofar as they could possibly do that, and they achieved a great deal of that. So all of the former Confederate states had post-Reconstruction conventions whose avowed aim was to disenfranchise African Americans. In Virginia, that was 1901, 1902. And not too long ago, I had read those debates a long time ago, and I reread some of them. And none of it is surprising, but even so, by modern standards, they're pretty shocking, because they talk in ways of Anglo-Saxon superiority, that they are born to rule, blacks are meant to be inferior, that it's God's plan, that history ordains it. And they say, well, what is the place for black Virginians? Well, in the cotton fields and in the tobacco barns and in effect as agricultural laborers. So they set about a number of devices which had first been used in Mississippi, were barred, finally used in Virginia. Poll tax was one of them. $1.50 a year doesn't sound like much money, but to a working man at that time, it was a lot of money. But more specifically, very onerous registration requirements. They laid it out. Now, if you were a Confederate veteran or the son of a Confederate veteran, you got a free pass. But otherwise, you had to go to the registrar, who could open up the Virginia Constitution to any page at random and ask you to interpret the provision. Well, there are provisions of the Virginia Constitution I can't interpret, that I would always know what they meant. And obviously it was devised, you go to the registrar and you're the wrong color, and you're going to be turned away. Your explanation, no matter how learned you are, is not going to satisfy the registrar. So everybody knew that. So for most black Virginians, they weren't going to take a day off from work and went to go to the registrar when it would be an act of futility. Well, the 1901-1902 delegates achieved their purpose of disenfranchisement with what I would have to call grim efficiency. That in 1870, after the Civil War, about half of the registered voters in Virginia were black. And after the 1902 Constitution came into being, it was less than 5%. So and not only blacks were disenfranchised, quite a number of poor whites were caught up in the net as well. So as you turned into the 20th century, it was the age of the so-called Byrd machine, Harry Byrd, who ruled the state through courthouse rings and the like, and it rested on a limited franchise. Well, that's the way it went for the first half of the 20th century. Things began to change pretty rapidly in the 1960s, because that was the age in which, of course, a very turbulent decade, Vietnam protests and assassinations of John Kennedy, Robert F. Kennedy, Martin Luther King. On the federal level, changes came into place like the Voting Rights Act of 1965, the one person, one vote decisions of the U.S. Supreme Court, the Supreme Court striking down the poll tax. I mean, it really took the props out from under Byrd machine rule, and things began to change. And that was the point where Governor Mills Godwin appointed the Commission on Constitutional Revision, a pretty remarkable set of commissioners, Lewis Powell, who later sat on the U.S. Supreme Court, Hardy Dillard, Dean of the Law School, later sat on the World Court of The Hague, Oliver Hill, who was at that time the Thurgood Marshall of Virginia. He was Virginia's leading civil rights attorney, and so forth. Really remarkable. Colgate Darden, former UVA president, former Virginia governor. In every sense of Blue Ribbon Commission, they needed someone to sort of help them out at the drafting level and the like, and that was when they came to me. And I didn't tell them this, but I, at that point, I hadn't read the old Virginia Constitution. You know, I thought that would spoil my copybook. But I said, oh, you want to write a constitution? No problem. I could, you know, I was a young law professor. I figured, what was I going to do? Go to the form book like you would for a will or a deed, maybe, and write a constitution? Well, I learned it wasn't that simple by any means. So we went to work, turned out a draft, then went to the General Assembly for the legislature's approval, and then finally to the vote of the people, a ratification campaign. By then, Governor Linwood Holton, the first Republican since Reconstruction, had become Virginia's governor. He asked me if I'd run the referendum campaign. Well, like the drafting stage, I'd never been involved in a major campaign. I'd been a poll worker, that kind of stuff. But I took that on and took leave from the law school and went all over the state making speeches, setting up campaign committees and the like. Indeed, I found in my dresser drawer the other day a campaign button. It simply says, yes. Yes, we want to drive home the point that this was a good thing. Don't ask any questions. Just vote yes. That's all you want to know. And I learned about conspiracy theories. There were people who said, oh, this new constitution could not have been written in Virginia. You know, Virginians wouldn't take the old constitution away from us. It must have been written in Beijing or Moscow or worse yet, in New York or Chicago, you know, but surely not in Virginia. Well, my job was to tamp down that sort of thing. Luckily, we didn't have social media and the like to spread those poisons. So we went on the campaign trail. We did fine when it came to election day, 72%. Most candidates for office would be thrilled to have anything like 72%. So we put it into place. That it became effect July the 1st, 1971, just over 50 years ago now. So looking back on it, what did it accomplish? Well, most importantly, it put out of sight the 1902 Constitution. It completely not only removed racist language, of which there was a good deal, but made substantive changes. For example, for the first time, the Virginia Constitution now has an anti-discrimination clause, ironically also including women as well as racial or ethnic discrimination. Virginia didn't ratify ERA at the time, but it had a little ERA, kind of an irony there. So anti-discrimination clause, education, there's now a mandate on the assembly to have a statewide system, including a mandate to localities that once the legislature apportions school funding, the locality is obliged then to put up its share. And in my reading, the Attorney General could mandamus a county or city to do that. So no more Prince Edward counties, no more closed schools. Standards of quality, the education article for the first time includes primacy in the Board of Education to fix standards of quality, subject finally to legislative approval. So it's a complete revamping of the whole system of public education. There are other ways. The vote is better supported. Apportionment, the 1971 Constitution requires that legislative districts be compact and contiguous. Unfortunately, the Supreme Court of Virginia has been a bit lax in enforcing that. They don't want to really challenge the legislature. I mean, you can strike down some other statute, but you better not mess with my legislative district. So, and so, as you know, we now have a recent amendment which creates a sort of bipartite commission that's half legislators, half half citizens. So those are some of the things that have happened. Obviously, in our discussion this afternoon, you may want to raise questions about particular things. I mean, would I change anything? Yes. There are things I think we were not tough enough in guaranteeing the restoration of the vote to former felons. Again, the Supreme Court of Virginia has been, I think, too weak in enforcing that provision. Term for governor, you know, we're the last state in the country that has one term and no right of succession. You could probably think of others, but I would say, and obviously I'm an interested party, but I think looking back over these decades since 1971, I think the Constitution has stood the test of time pretty well. Indeed, we may have been fortunate that we did it when we did, because I would frankly not be very optimistic about the prospect of rewriting the Constitution today. Partisanship that's become so divisive has become part of the Virginia scene as well as the national scene. I mentioned social media. You can imagine all the misinformation that would be put out. It would be very difficult, in fact, to bring people together to write the document in the first place. If all the special interest groups would want to be at the table, they would demand that their particular thing be done, or they wouldn't have it at all. So we probably, I don't want to make it sound like a golden age, that sort of Whig history, if you like, but I think we were lucky to have the leadership we did, the sort of general consensus in Virginia to put the state constitution on a solid basis. So I feel, looking back over it, as I say, there are some changes I would make. But by and large, I think it's done pretty well. So that would be my sum at this point, and turn it back over to you.
Well, Professor Howard, before we turn to Professor Schreiber, I want to just ask you to underscore, as I understand it, and I think you told me this, at the point at which Virginia had the referendum on its constitution, there were two other states that had tried to redo their constitutions and been unable to get them to pass. Is that right?
That's exactly right. In the 60s and 70s, there was any number of states tried to rewrite constitutions, partly because of the Voting Rights Act and the one-person, one-vote decisions and the seismic sort of shift in the federal aspect against which state constitutions are measured. And it's striking that some of the states, New York was one state, Maryland was another. Maryland had a constitutional convention where they wrote a model constitution. But one of the lessons, I think, of constitution making is to remember politics. That it's one thing to write a classroom exercise, something else to get something through the legislature and the people. And in Maryland, what they did, they took the constitutional officers, like the sheriffs and the commissioners of revenue, out of the Constitution, put them in the statute books. Sounds like a good idea. But those office holders didn't like it. They wanted to stay in the Constitution. And so when the Maryland proposed Constitution went to the ballot, it lost in every county in Maryland except two, Prince George's and Montgomery. It lost by margins of 8-1 in some of the Eastern Shore counties. So I talked to those folks in Maryland and came back and talked to our people. And I said, you might want to do that, but I don't think it's a good idea. And so we left the officers in the Constitution, and all five statewide associations went on record during the referendum in favor of the Constitution. So whatever you want to do in the world of ideal constitutionalism, one has to remember that you have to get out there and sell it to people.
That is a very good transition, particularly as we think about the role of local constitutional officers, Professor Schreiber, to, I think, what you have put forth in your paper.
Thank you, Aaron. Thanks, everyone, for coming and to the Journal of Law and Politics for hosting this. And thank you, Dick. This is really an honor also for me to to be a part of this panel, and to think of you as the constitutional salesman of 1971, which I can see you out there with the button. It's fabulous. I'm gonna talk a little bit about what didn't make it into the Constitution. It's not a criticism of Professor Howard or the commission, which had put in a home rule provision, but which somehow it got lost in between it being put in and then the vote on the final document. And so I want to talk a little bit about that. My co-author, Alex Retzloff, is here. Great to see you. Thanks, Alex. Any mistakes I make will be blamed on him, and he will also be able to correct when I go awry. But so address your questions over there. That would be the best. Let me just say a little bit about what home rule even is, for those of you that don't know, and contrast it with what we have in Virginia, which is we're called a Dillon's rule state. And let me just say a little bit about both of those things, and then describe why it matters, and then why it was interesting in terms of the Constitution of 1971 and what came before. Home rule is a general term for state constitutions or state statutes that give power to local governments, often cities, but sometimes counties, and also maybe even school districts, that give power to local governments to do stuff. It's a general grant of authority in a state constitution. Often it's the power of initiative. That is, it says, you, local governments, get to do all the things that the legislature could otherwise do. It doesn't, though, usually protect the local government from preemptive state law. So if the state disagrees, they can pass a law. Although in some states, there is some sphere of what's called immunity from contrary state laws. But in general, it's just a grant that says you don't need to come to the state legislature to get permission to pass laws. Now, this sounds pretty uncontroversial and quite easy. And in fact, I think the commission thought this was pretty uncontroversial, as most state constitutions had some form of home rule. But in Virginia, it turns out the history of trying to give local governments power, and this goes to Aaron's point about who gets to decide issues. The history of local government power in Virginia has been quite, mixed is the best word to say about it, but really quite centralizing in lots of ways and continues to be so. So we're what's called a Dillon's rule state. Dillon's rule is named after a judge and a treatise writer named John Dillon, who said that the powers of local governments are only what the legislature says they are, essentially, and that they must be read strictly against the local government when the local government is trying to assert a certain kind of power. So, for example, if you want to take down your Confederate monument here in Charlottesville, or even put one up, right, which is originally what happened, you would need authorization from the state, right? This is the kind of issue. But there's many other issues. If you want to adopt a minimum wage law, a plastic bag ban, environmental legislation, anti-discrimination laws, sanctuary city laws, gun laws, etc. All of that stuff has to be authorized by some kind of explicit grant from the state. The home rule provision in 1971 was there, and then it disappeared, as I pointed out. And again, it seemed uncontroversial in an era when cities and local governments where urbanization was happening quite rapidly, and there was lots of stuff that cities were trying to do that they didn't need to go back to the legislature to get permission for. But it failed, and again, there's a history to this. So this history goes all the way back to Jefferson. Jefferson wanted to reform local government in Virginia too in the 1830 Constitution. He didn't like the way it was structured in the 1776 Constitution because he was a big fan of the ward system in New England, which was known as townships, actually. So he thought townships were great. He wanted to adopt a township type system in Virginia based on his idea of wards, famously. Nobody listened to Jefferson in 1830. He failed to get that to happen. And we don't see any kind of real reform of the local government system, which again, Dick alluded to this, is based on the county circuit court kind of system and these constitutional officers, which exercise power through what some have called plantation localism. Plantation localism is the planters get to exercise power over both, obviously, the slave population, but also the poor whites as well. And that's the form of local government that you basically have. Later, after the Civil War, we do have a small period of time where the Reconstruction legislature does adopt a township system in Virginia, but it's then eliminated a few years later when Reconstruction passes, right, and the South obtains these reobtains its authority. And we see at this in the 1902 Constitution. Again, no kind of, there's some inklings of home rule, but not really. One of the things that's going on here, we think, is fear of black control of local governments, right? And so plantation localism is replaced by what we might call Jim Crow localism. Again, organized around this county court system that's operated in large part through the Byrd machine that Professor Howard just mentioned. This is through massive resistance. This is up through the 60s, right? And then the Byrd machine is starting to be dismantled when this 1971 Constitution comes along. So it seems like a moment when you can get all these changes plus some home rule. And for a local government guy, that's really exciting. I was only 1 year old, but I would have voted for the. So why does it fail? We're not really sure. There's sort of a weird story here. One possibility is in 1970, 1971, we're seeing a lot of shifting demographics in the state. And so there's more urbanization, where Virginia's kind of a rural state, but now things are growing. Not so much necessarily Northern Virginia, which is now the big population center around here, but Richmond, Norfolk, these kinds of areas, some of these bigger rural counties. And some cities are starting to move to possibly majority black status, like Richmond. And this is worrying the local officials and the state officials. They're not part of the Jim Crow Constitution, but they're still a little bit concerned about majority black cities exercising certain kinds of power. So what you see in the 60s and the 70s are defensive incorporations and defensive annexations. What this means is, say, Richmond is becoming more, as African-American residents are increasing, the population of African-American residents are increasing, what Richmond goes out to do is try to annex a predominantly white portion of the surrounding county. This was challenged on voting rights grounds by African Americans in Richmond, and they won, although the remedy wasn't to eliminate that that annexation. There were other remedies developed. But there was lots of action on the local level about changing boundaries to adjust to these new kinds of demographic realities, which did threaten or seem to threaten some of the white dominance of local governments and, in fact, of state governments. That doesn't explain necessarily why the home rule provision was rejected. There's another possibility, which is the Virginia Way, which was sort of the General Assembly running the show, was something that people were used to and local governments were satisfied with that. But what we've seen recently, and thereafter, frankly, right, in the 80s and the 90s, there have always been revisiting the home rule problem with commissions and various other things, saying, well, this doesn't make a lot of sense. Dillon's rule doesn't exist in most states, at least not for big cities or big counties. This doesn't make sense in Virginia. And what we've seen more recently, of course, is places like Charlottesville, Alexandria, Richmond, chafing under a system which requires them to go back to the legislature for any departure from state law, but also for any action that state law doesn't cover, but which is not authorized by state law. So you get scooters in Charlottesville, and there's no authorization under state law to regulate them, so Charlottesville doesn't know if they can regulate scooters, right? These kinds of things. That's the fact of a Dillon's Rule kind of state. And so we've seen some energy more recently to revisit Dillon's Rule, not a ton yet, because politically I think it's tricky to do any of this kind of rejiggering of the state-local relationship. But we've also seen this nationally, the relationship between states and cities has become much more polarized, much more divisive. And home rule is one of those issues that is always percolating around those divisive issues. Thank you.
Thanks. Just in listening to you talk, I've been reflecting on part of what I do, which is one of the many things the Attorney General's office does is defend the constitutionality and the prerogatives at the state level. And when we defend an enactment of the legislature, we have this canon we fall back on, which is acts of the legislature presumed to be constitutional. We start every case defending an act of the legislature a step up, right? Because of that presumption. And the Virginia Constitution says something really interesting, and Professor Howard, I don't know if this is repeated in lots of state constitutions or if this was a deliberate choice, which is that the expression of popular sovereignty, the sovereignty of the people in Virginia, rests in the legislature. That's a really interesting choice, and part of what you have raised is it is a choice. And someone who also has to defend the governor, that's another interesting choice. By contrast, if you are a county attorney defending something that the county has done, you start every case a step behind because you have to deal with Dillon's Rule. And then maybe, and I'm gonna mix city and town, and Virginia's a little weird on that too, right? Because we have independent cities. But you might have to go back to your charter, which is reflected on by the legislature. You might have to go to specific enactments. I think the city of Roanoke, which is a place I dearly love and have spent a lot of time, had to get legislative help to be able to ban smoking at certain outdoor venues, right? So things that have this high degree of specificity, you would not expect to go to Richmond, often do. I want to pose a question to you, which is, in what ways does the debate over home rule, you think, mirror a debate about federalism? And in what ways is it different, right?
Yeah. So I think there are very quite similar issues, right? The big difference is, in fact, obviously states have much more constitutional protection vis-a-vis the federal government. Cities would love to have even a little bit of that. So for example, the anti-commandeering doctrine and the coercive spending doctrine at the federal level, there's no such thing at the state level. And so even outside Virginia, and we've seen this in places like Florida and Texas and other places, let's take mask mandates at local schools. If the governor says you can't have a mask mandate in your local school, and we will take away your money if you try to, right? Or you can't remove your Confederate monument, Birmingham, Alabama, and if you try to, we will take away your money. This is perfectly acceptable in most, even in state constitutional systems that have some home rule. So in fact, home rule doesn't even protect you from some of those things. In Virginia, we're even further back from that because you wouldn't be able to assert the authority to do any of those things anyway, regardless of the strings, the financial strings that are attached to you. But the theoretical question is a similar one, which is at what level of government should activities take place and what are the benefits of vertically divided government? And one of my colleagues, Richard Brafault, says if you like states, if you're in favor of sort of federalism as a state-based, you should love cities because local governments also provide many of the benefits that one would ascribe to having a divided system of government, a vertically divided system of government.
Professor Howard, I'm curious, when you think back on the, and I don't know what sort of privilege one invokes about the drafting of a constitution, so don't let me overstep, but as you think back on the central problems that you faced in putting together the 1971 Constitution. And one of the first things you told me years ago, you told a class talking about constitutionalism when I was a student, that I always remember is that, Professor Howard has been called on around the world to consult with people who are writing constitutions. And I think you may have spent a lot of time in Eastern Europe after the fall of the Berlin Wall, was that you have to be very careful with your notion of community and citizenship, particularly as it comes to religious and ethnic divisions. And so as you think back on the world in 1970, 1971, can you comment on how that notion of community and location was in the minds of those putting this together?
I think it was very much, they might not have used the phrase political community. That's the one I've been using here because it really echoes the language of George Mason in the 1776 Declaration of Rights. But I think it was a central concern. I really think you might put it different ways. I've also mentioned who counts and who doesn't, who belongs and who doesn't. And I must say my sense of that was sharpened by traveling in Central and Eastern Europe after the Berlin Wall came down and communism imploded. I was working with drafters in places like Budapest and Warsaw and Prague and some of the other capitals of Eastern Europe. And so many of those countries have a national minority problem. You know, you'll have, let's say, Hungarians who live in Romania, they're a distinct minority. And in those, if you're following the news, Viktor Orban in Hungary and the Law and Justice Party in Poland, you're very much aware of how ethnicity and race and other divisions count. And frequently people in power appeal to their base, if I may borrow an American word, they appeal to their base by distinguishing between them and the others. It's the Muslims at the gate kind of thing in Hungary. It may be the bureaucrats in Brussels, but always somebody else doesn't respect you, doesn't understand you. And I think that's an international sort of echo of the sort of thing that has been going on, especially in southern states, but not just in the South. I mean, in the post-Reconstruction period, leading up to 1902 in Virginia, obviously a burning question for conservatives in places like Virginia at the turn of the 20th century was how to put blacks in their place, to put them back where they belong, to get them out of public life. Something like that was going on in northern states as well as the immigration began to shift from Germany and Western Europe to places like Italy. Maybe the Irish had come a bit earlier, Eastern Europeans, Jews from Russia and the rest of it. And so you had in the North similar movements to keep those people out of public life because they weren't really like the traditional Americans. So one reason I think that we inherited what we did in 1902 was that the North was preoccupied with immigration and getting on with making money and the like, and they weren't too concerned about what white Southerners were doing to blacks in their own ranks. We inherited that, as I said a moment ago, after decades of bird machine rule. Then you get to the revision that took place and produced the 1971 Constitution. And I think if there was any one thing that the revisors agreed upon, it was, again, what I've characterized as a sense of community, that Virginians were entitled to be treated equally. That's why the anti-discrimination clause was put in, the first one we'd ever had. And it wasn't simply limited to the franchise and the vote, although that was obviously very much at the center of it. It was things like segregated schools. The 1902 Constitution explicitly proclaimed that white and colored, using the phrase they did then, white and colored children would not be taught in the same schools. That's another way of signaling to a segment of the population, you don't belong, you don't count, you're second-class citizens. So just as national minorities in so many countries of the world are second-class, so blacks in Virginia were treated as being second-class. So I think that was at the heart of it. The problem hasn't been completely solved. I mentioned how I think the commission that wrote the present Constitution wasn't sufficiently vigilant about restoring the voting rights of former felons. Obviously, that's a classification on its face, which is not racial, but statistics would remind us that proportionate to population, more blacks are former felons than whites. And I think we that's one of the problems we still ought to deal with. But I think it's in the spirit of the framers of this 1971 Constitution to not forget that from the beginning in America, race has been part of the problem. It may have been swept away, it dealt with one way or the other, but it's there. It's not the whole picture by any means, but it's an important part of it.
So I have a question that is a little bit of a shift, and I'd appreciate your reaction. So if part of the idea, right, is that your political community does better as more people are able to participate and do participate, I'm curious in your reaction to voter turnout levels and media attention for different levels of government, right? And so those of us who are in part, right, tasked to deal with elections know you have your biggest voter turnout when there is a presidential election, bigger turnout for federal, when there's a federal election on the ballot than state. State turnout is better than local. There's a little bit of a chicken the egg problem, right? Because for years, many local elections in Virginia were held in May instead of November, in part to keep turnout down. And that's something that the legislature recently fixed. But even when you have a ballot, right, and you know the phrase down ballot, the further down the ballot you go, the less likely you are to have seen an ad. Maybe you don't even know the names of the people on the ballot. The fewer votes you get. People almost always vote for that first one on the ballot, but not the one on the last. And so I'm curious as to how that plays into a debate about home rule and also to what degree this is a chicken and the egg problem.
Yeah, it's great. So this is the common view. Why would you vote for local officials? They don't either do anything or it's a waste of time or they're not contested elections in many cases, right? They're begging for someone to run for the school board or something like that. And there's the chicken and egg problem, as you say, which is, well, if you've disempowered your local governments, then the voters are probably right. There's no reason to vote for them. All the power's at the center. So I think that's a little bit troubling. The other part of this is our local elections have become in some ways, I'm not quite sure about how the dynamic here works, but have in some ways become nationalized, which is you have some debate at the local level in say the city council, and it suddenly becomes a referendum on Trump versus Biden, right? So we've created a polarized, nationalized kind of politics, which actually to me is a feature I've written recently of the kind of the urban-rural split, which is in fact a kind of a local split. It's a metropolitan area split that has gone national in a way. That's how I would characterize this. But that kind of nationalization is problematic both for state offices and as Professor Howard says, I don't think you could do a constitutional revision today for this reason. It would get caught up in the national political waves. So we do seem to pay more attention, right, and vote more often in these national elections, but that may be a structural problem that we actually want to address by devolving power more, right, giving more power to localities.
So thank you so much. And where are our two organizers? Thank you. I know that you do not get class credit for this. And I really appreciate you taking the time to organize this for us. Thank you.